Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Paul Venable with us. And we've been doing a kind of a good clip getting through the Virginia ratification debates. How are you doing, Paul?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we left off where Madison was replying to George Mason, because George Mason basically provided the recipe, or he broke down what it would take for the militia to become inept and, you know, obsolete. And so, and we actually see, you know, what they ended up doing. And folks, I kind of address how to bring the militia back in, you know, my presidential series. Not sure if you've been listening to those, Paul, but anyway.
Yesterday. Yeah, I've been listening to those.
And so Madison responded regarding a standing army. And because we kind of ran out of time, the one thing that he basically says, I'm most cordially, you know, this is what Madison said regarding what Mason said. I most cordially agree with the honorable member last up that a standing army is one of the greatest mischiefs that can possibly happen. And so they kind of go through this. But folks, as they define what the standing army is, it has nothing to do with the military. It had everything to, because the mischief that a standing army is when they start oppressing the folks in using the standing army to enforce the arbitrary laws, you know, like what we see with the federal government with the pandemic and what we're going to see with the taxation. I mean, that's what they've been doing, and they kind of have been growing and growing these standing armies. But why? Because it's about time they started exerting excessive force. And they're getting ready to exert excessive force. This is probably why they've been buying up bullets and been making it hard and impossible for people to, you know, maintain, you know, what they want to do with their Second Amendment rights. So anyway, so we go on. And, you know, this is where Madison kind of talks about the martial law parameters. And so this is where he basically gets into how martial law is to be exercised. Now, folks, why is this important? Because I've said this a lot, and I've not said this probably once since we've been reading the ratification debates. As they're stipulating how these terms are defined, as they're stipulating how the this one clause, or because martial law is not mentioned in the Constitution, but they go there because it becomes a part of the militia. And so when they stipulate, when they actually go in and say, well, this is how it is to be done under this Constitution, those right there are legally defined terms of the compact. In other words, they're legally binding terms and definitions that have been provided in the selling of the compact to the states. And so when we're all done with this, there'll be a letter I'm going to read that'll basically go down this path of Madison's response to a bunch of gentlemen that wanted to know how the men during the Constitutional Convention defined the Constitution. And Madison, in essence, basically just states, it doesn't matter what we thought. The only thing that matters is what the states understood the Constitution to mean at the time of ratification, because they actually got into, you know, the some of the details that, believe it or not, they probably didn't even cover martial law and those types of things during the Constitutional Convention. Remember, one of the biggest contentions that they actually struggled over was the selection of the president and how to do that, and the intricacies regarding the Electoral College. And, you know, you and I have talked about this, Paul, that When you read the Electoral College, you know, it kind of talks in a general term, but it's very specific, but not specific enough to help everybody understand that the people are to choose their electors. Now, we found that in Massachusetts and in some of the other debates, that it is the people that are to choose their electors. But, you know, they didn't provide some of the verbosity, some of the, you know, the necessary details and the words, you know, the fine print kind of thing of, you know, how we're to interface with this Electoral College. It only talks about how the Electoral College is, you know, once we've selected them, how they function after that. Anyway.
Okay.
Anywho. So moving forward, are you with me here? We're right at the top of martial law.
We are.
Okay.
And I'm ready when you are.
Go ahead. Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. The honorable member is under another mistake. He wishes martial law to be exercised only in time of war, under an idea that Congress can establish it in time of peace. That's interesting. Oh, just a minute, GR. Who had the idea that Congress could establish martial law in time of peace?
Well, it was probably brought up by Mason up above, that they could just declare it any time and deploy it any time.
Okay.
Right.
So Madison is calling this a mistake. And now he's going to explain why, I guess. All right. The states are to have the authority of training the militia according to the congressional discipline and of governing them at all times when not in the service of the Union. Sorry, GR.
Okay.
When not in the service of the Union. Congress is to govern such part of them as may be employed in the actual service of the United States, and such part only can be subject to martial law. So this is the part that can be subject to martial law. Okay. The gentlemen in opposition have drawn a most tremendous picture of the Constitution in this respect without considering that the power was absolutely indispensable. They have alarmed us with a possible abuse of it, but have shown no inducement or motive to tempt them to such abuse. Would the legislature of the state drag the militia of the eastern shore to the western frontiers, or those of the western frontiers to the eastern shore, if the local militia were sufficient to effect the intended purpose. There is something so preposterous and so full of mischief in the idea of dragging the militia unnecessarily from one end of the continent to the others that I think there can be no ground of apprehension. If you limit their power over the militia, you give them a pretext for substituting a standing army.
There you go. So let's stop right here. Let's look at this concept of the powers. The only reason why the federal government can reach into the states and to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. Now, in the history, that we know that they called up the militia for the 1812 war. But prior to that, the Whiskey Rebellion was the other reason. Now, as you look at how the federal government was operating, they were pretty much, you know, executing the laws of the Union by, you know, collecting taxes, imposts, and so forth. Now, how many times did they call up the militia to execute the laws of the Union?
I can't put my finger on that except for that. And as you said, the War of 1812.
Well, yeah, so that was...
Are you saying that there wasn't that much experience in calling forth the militia?
Well, so there's that, but there wasn't a necessity of executing the laws of the Union because the marshals and the sheriffs and the state operatives were capable of actually doing the job.
Right.
And so when you really look at if you're going to deploy a new law, let's say the federal government constitutionally incorporated an idea of prohibition of alcohol. Let's just say they did that.
Okay.
Well, the Constitution's clear, and it was never amended out in this amendment, that, you know, the militia would not be the ones executing the laws of the Union, that the federal government would have to create a new, you know, entity, like maybe an alcohol, tobacco, you know, or a liquor law force or something like that. And so if you look at whatever amendment that was, and actually we do have real context to this, go look at that amendment. They didn't change Article 1, Section 8 to take away the militia's responsibility of executing the laws of the union. And nor did they give them the ability to actually fund and create a standing army. That armies were not to be created that, you know, could not be basically, you know, disassembled, decommissioned after 2 years. Right. So for them to actually create an entity like an alcohol enforcement or maybe a Federal Bureau of Investigations type of entity, that in itself, even though they didn't call it a standing army, it was a federal law enforcement agency that was a standing army.
Right.
And the only way to constitutionally they could have done that was to call forth the militia to do it. See, what Mason was really concerned with was the ability to bring in professionals that had no ties to the community whatsoever. Mm-hmm. See, the whole point was, and the checks and balance in the Constitution was that we were the ones that had to enforce the laws upon ourselves.
And so, in other words, if we had done this right, the militia would have been enforcing the prohibition.
The prohibition, absolutely. And so here's the thing. You would find, and so they knew this, and it doesn't matter. In other words, if the nature of the amendment was one that was tyrannical, then the people would not become despotic on their own. In other words, you know, what's the likelihood that you would, you know, you'd go in and bust your brother Still, or, you know, your family's involvement in creating liquors and so forth. And, you know, they're not doing any harm. And it's just because it's a violation of the law.
So. Right. So let me pass this on a little further. Okay, so here we are. We've got local militias enforcing the law, and we have the states that passed, you know, the prohibition.
Right.
And just I'm just imagining this scenario because, and then you've got people, neighbors, you know, kind of engaged in making alcohol. I'm just trying to figure out something. How would that go? You know, in other words, let's suppose that this was like fairly entrenched, and now you have the militia kind of enforcing the law in itself on their family members or in the local community. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words,
yes.
In other words, is it? I'm trying to figure out how that would work.
So, I kind of talked.
The tenor of my question.
Yeah, so I've been kind of covering this, and in the presidential, my presidential campaign episodes that I've got going on Mondays, I'm diving into the militia. See, the federal government with the Whiskey Rebellion was actually not; they were deploying the militia to deal with an insurrection, and so they didn't need to worry about. Or they realized that they couldn't necessarily use, you know, just the Pennsylvania force, because there's going to be an apprehension when you're talking about civil war, or when you're talking about, you know, enforcing laws with maybe people you know. Sometimes it's best to have, you know, a mixture so that, you know, you actually get the law enforced, because the job is to get the law enforced. So, but they weren't enforcing the law. They were suppressing an insurrection. They've never actually deployed the militia, nor did I think that they ever imagined that they needed to. What should have happened and what should happen when they created this law for prohibition, the governor should have called forth the militia to say, hey, look, we're going to have to call you up, you know, and be prepared. But see, at this point in time, the militia had already been meddled with, and the militia right. was not proportionate towards counties. It was just basically the apportionment was done by the, you know, the Army Reserves.
Right.
And so whoever, you know, was in the Army Reserves at the time, they weren't making sure that each county had appropriate representation in the militia. So anyway, so it was already problematic. They had already been ignoring it. And this is why they just quickly made and created this force. Bottom line, what we have to do as a nation is we actually have to go through a paradigm shift and realize that the law enforcement, you know, what we're going to enforce, we must inflict upon ourselves. Mm-hmm. As truly an enlightened society, we should all agree that these laws must be enforced, whether they be drug laws or what have you. They can't be federal laws. It's best that, you know, because the federal government didn't, other than this prohibition, they didn't have any other law enforcement that they could actually enforce. They have no, there's no federal crimes that have been amended to the Constitution, whether that be child trafficking and all this other stuff. And so we really, by going down the path of creating professional law enforcement, municipal law enforcement, and having full-time sheriff law enforcement, we create we create the opportunity of actually creating a corrupt organization. Because once you've created an organization and you allow it to take its natural course of organizing, it just takes the wrong person to actually, you know, corrupt that organization. And it's not the same as the militia, because the militia is everybody.
Right. Well, the other thing is organizations tend to want to grow themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because
it's just the nature of
the
critter.
The larger they get, the more pleasure that they obtain by controlling more people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I've seen that time and time again. As a matter of fact, you know, I've worked with people that, you know, said, hey, you know, why aren't you growing your organization? You got a great opportunity here, and you're not. Actually, I gave up parts of my organization to go to other departments because it made sense. Not that they were trying to grow their organization and it wasn't a conflict between us, but it only made sense that, you know, these resources would probably be better served in that position. And we had criteria that they were supposed to do these very specific things. And actually, in one particular case, when it came to networking, I'm going down a rat hole here, but when it came to networking and systems integration and design, they were supposed to be doing the design and they weren't. And so I actually had to go to the director and I said, look, we made an agreement that we pulled them over so that they would be involved in that, and you're not involving them. So either I bring them back and we'll make you guys miserable again, because now we'll actually be, you know, giving you direct feedback externally instead of you, because they came back to me and they would get all frustrated because they weren't involved in the designing as well. And so long story short, that does happen. You see that natural tendency of trying to create a bigger and bigger entity, and because it's about power.
Yeah, there's something else that I experienced when I was in Idaho, and I spent some time lobbying the legislature, and that is, people who were elected had been in business, and so they came. You know, here's the mindset: you're growing your business, you're growing your family. So they get into government, and even though they may call themselves conservatives, they've got this mentality that they're supposed to grow whatever they're in. And so they're growing government. No, that's not how it works.
Right.
And so people have to, there has to be a paradigm shift, like you were saying, that some things aren't designed to be grown. Okay. That's not, it doesn't, it's not a one size fits all.
Right.
That's what comes to mind.
Yep.
Okay.
Sure.
All right.
Okay.
You want me to finish a paragraph here?
Yes. No, so go ahead and actually finish the rest of this. I just wanted to take this. There's the paragraph and then the subsequent paragraph. And then actually, if you notice, then Mr. Clay responds, then Mr. Madison responds. So there's a little bit more here. So, yeah, go ahead and finish all of it now.
If you put it in the power of the state governments to refuse the militia by requiring their consent, you destroy the general government and sacrifice particular states. Same principles and motives which produce disobedience to requisitions will produce refusal in this case. The restrictions which the honorable gentleman mentioned to be in the British Constitution are all provisions against the power of the executive magistrate. But the House of Commons may, if they be so disposed, sacrifice the interest of their constituents in all those cases. They may prolong the duration of mutiny bills and grant supplies to the king to carry on an impolitic war. But they have no motives to do so, for they have strong motives to do their duty. We have more ample security than the people of Great Britain. The powers of the government are more limited and guarded, and our representatives are more responsible than the members of the British House of Commons. So then Mr. Clay responds, speaking of the sheriff, right? Apprehended that by this power, our government, excuse me, apprehended that by this power, our militia might be sent to the Mississippi. He observed that the sheriff might raise the posse comitatus to execute the laws. He feared it would lead to the establishment of a military government as the militia were to be called forth to put the laws into execution. He asked why this mode was preferred to the old established custom of executing the laws. Can you address this for just a second? Because he refers to posse comitatus, you know, it's just not something that everyone is familiar with.
Well, so actually, let's let Madison address it because he responds.
Oh. Okay. Mr. Madison answered that the power existed in all countries, that the militia might be called forth for that purpose under the laws of this state and every other state in the Union. The public force must be used when resistance to the laws required it. Otherwise, society itself must be destroyed. That the mode referred to by the gentleman might not be sufficient on every occasion, as the sheriff must be necessarily restricted to the posse of his own county. If the posse of one county were insufficient to overcome the resistance to the execution of the laws, this power must be resorted to. He did not by any means admit that the old mode was suspended by the introduction of the new one.
Superseded.
Go ahead.
Superseded, not suspended.
Oh, did I say superseded?
No, you said suspended.
Yeah, he did not by any means, admit that the old mode was superseded by the introduction of the new one. And it was obvious to him that when the civil power was insufficient, this mode would never be put in practice.
Not insufficient, but when it was sufficient, that this mode would never be put into practice. So it's okay. You know, 9 times out of 10, when you change a word, if it doesn't really change the context, then you know, it doesn't matter to me. But those two words, you know, the context was important.
Well, I'm going back to the glasses. I'm due to get some glasses tomorrow.
Oh, so okay. That's well, you're doing really well with what you got. So,
all right.
So bottom line, what Madison is saying is that the sheriff should never take his posse and actually go into Mississippi. As a matter of fact, the sheriff would never leave because if the militia was called up, it would only call up parts of those people of the county. The sheriff would not be called up. He still has a job and he still has a requirement. So this actually, because I talk about this, and I think I touched on the fact that we need to look at the militia. Now we're running out of time. We're actually going into break right here. So folks, what we'll do is I'm going to keep this at the forefront so that when we come back from the break, I'll be able to actually address, you know, some of these issues regarding the militia and what I'm talking about on my Monday show. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what we were just talking about, and actually I want people to really understand this, because I don't think they did a good job. I think what the Lord gave them, and the reason that they didn't do a good job was because they were good people. Let me explain. We actually received a system that would actually allow us and actually required us to enforce the laws, all of the laws. And in those days, they didn't have a lot of laws. You know, they didn't have piles and piles of code and statutes. They just, you know, they behaved civilly. And they kind of learned, even though it wasn't a part of the curriculum, of how to have difficult conversations, you know, because they didn't have all these different modes of communication. They either wrote or they spoke. They didn't have, you know, texting. They didn't have social media with memes. I mean, how people communicate today, you know, you can actually see how we have underdeveloped people in our society in understanding how to interface with another human being. And so they also lived in a community, and there was, even though you had some privacy in your own home and so forth, I mean, your behavior, your family behavior, and those types of things was kind of well known. But so anyway, long story short is that we were given a system where everybody had a responsibility of executing the laws of the union. The militia means everybody. Now, in the current times, I honestly see that when we say the militia means everybody, it really does now, right now, mean everybody. Everybody has to take their responsibility in stepping in and taking back our laws and taking back our country and the rule of law, because we can't do this with professional enforcement. If we do it with professional enforcement, it'll be done by the globalists. Because we don't have a professional enforcement. We actually have to organize so that we can, you know, make sure that we don't have professional enforcement, or there's even a good possibility, because I've talked about this, there's a possibility that China might be coming here. And so we actually need to start understanding we all have a responsibility to basically defend liberty and our society. And we have to start enforcing our laws. So I really talk about, and I haven't gotten into the details yet, but I will be, and I, you know, so we'll just try to keep it really short right here, and then I won't mention this again for the ratification debates, because it'll probably be old hat because I'll be covering it. But we have everybody has to get militia training, period, everybody. Men and women, if you're capable, if you don't have any physical infirmities, or if you're of the proper age, everybody is going to need to take either weekends or what have you as a responsibility in understanding what your job is going to be. And this is going to have to happen sooner rather than later, because the sooner we do this, the sooner we assume the proper responsibilities for our communities, for our liberty, for our lives, then the sooner we'll actually, because, you know, we're going to have to put aside our differences. There's going to be people that may be living in community. I mean, because you've got gangs and that type of stuff. And we have to assume that some of these people, if they're not going to be a part of this, then we need to actually, you know, invoke by law. We have to start removing citizenship. In other words, these people over here that aren't going to be, they're not willing to be a participant as a member of our society, then why are they citizens?
Mm.
We have to have some really difficult conversations really quick. And I think that we can do this. I believe that, you know, we're adult enough, and I believe that we're just smart enough. But we have to start acknowledging that there are people that just, they can't become a citizen. They can't maintain citizenship. They're not, you know, willing to change.
There are a couple things that I've heard here. One of them is that what you're saying is that if we, the people, are responsible to enforce our laws, then it removes kind of the responsibility of having a professional law enforcement. It sounds
absolutely,
like
absolutely, completely.
Long term, that's where we're going.
Right, and so really, all municipal law enforcement—in other words, your metro police departments—will go away, and your sheriff will actually create, you know, little in, you know, where you have a police department headquarters here in this part of the town, or, you know, this community, the Bronx, what have you. And, you know, all of those will actually be converted to sheriff offices. And the sheriff will have a, you know, a local commander that will be operating and working with the city or with the citizens of that community. And so, you know, right now the problem we have is that they're trying to do recruitments for law enforcement out of their own communities, or they say, hey, you know, if you're a law enforcement officer, if you move over here, you know, because they'll pay them to live there so that they become right. A part of the community. Well, this is absolutely stupid. Our militia was designed to do that already. And so they've been ignoring the militia because they didn't want it, because they knew that when we started actually getting and understanding these technicalities of our laws, this is how they lose their control.
Now, there's one other thing that I noticed, and I've been wondering just how to deal with this. Let's suppose, remember, in the last couple of years, we saw Portland burning and Seattle burning.
Yep.
You've got all of these people who, I mean, if we decided that we were going to get control of the law, and all of these people, you know, the cameras everywhere, and they found them, you know, you just said something that kind of opened my mind. I hadn't thought of it before. Maybe you can't put all these people in prison. Maybe you don't have enough room for them. What sounds like you're saying is they don't want to be citizens. They don't want to act like citizens. They don't want to govern themselves. Put them out with the invaders. That's what sounds like you're saying.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, man.
So anybody that really, you know, they're not willing to be a part of the self-government, and they want to be a part of a subjugated class of people, subjugated by the crown, subjugated by, you know, ambiguous powers, whether that's in Germany, whether that's in Russia. It doesn't matter. All of these countries are the same. None of them are guaranteed their liberties because their government is, you know, I use the word denned because that means contained, that their government is not contained by enumerated powers. Their government has general powers. You want a government that can do anything and everything? Then you need to leave here, because this is not the government that we have. And as long as we have a majority of the people, and I believe the majority of the people of America want to be a self-governing people, then everybody has to actually accept the fact that they're a part of that self-governing. They have to enforce the governing part. And so they, so every person's going to have to go through orientation. They're going to have to go through this, you know, this understanding of what their responsibilities are in enforcing the law. And we'll actually have literally three or four separate levels of the militia. We'll have the active force where they're wearing a uniform. They're wearing the sheriff's uniform. And but that force over time will deplete. I believe that we'll actually be able to reduce these big, huge, you know, police precincts down to small little offices.
Neighborhood.
Well, not even to that. I think that they'll just be able to reduce these big things down to small things, they'll be able to sell those and actually, you know, keep just a small part of that, because if we are all enforcing the law, and this is how it goes. So just because you're in uniform doesn't mean, because you have the active, those who are active, then you have the active reserve. In other words, these are the guys that have a uniform, you know, and that can be called on at a minute's notice. Or if they're in the vicinity and a crime is being committed, then, and by the way, everybody's carrying a gun. Everybody is carrying a gun, and you have to expect that everybody has a gun. Now, just in that mode right there, crime goes down dramatically. Just in that mode right there, crime goes down dramatically. Now, the only people that aren't carrying guns are children.
Militia, you're deputized.
Well, yes. So, okay. So you're deputized, but you're not deputized in active service. And there's going to be multiple levels because I haven't gotten into this, but you'll have the active reserve. And these are the guys that are on call. They are permanently on call. They're kind of like standby teachers or on call teachers. And then you have the inactive reserve. And then you'll have I'll just say inactive. They're not reserve at all. Mm-hmm. And the inactive are those people that are actually a part of the civilian government. But everybody has to have this training. Everybody has to have an understanding of what it takes. And, you know, that way, because you got to remember, we've read in the ratification debates that it was critical, essential, that enforcement was controlled by civilian people. In other words, it's the sheriff cannot be the top cop of the county.
Really?
Because he is actually, you know, he's a part of the military apparatus. And we're supposed to have a civilian, you know, the power is to be left into the hands of the people, of the politicians. The people are representatives, and so we have to have a representative governor of the county that will be the chief executive. The president may be the commander in chief, and the governors will be the commanders in chief, but they do not and are not a part of the military, which the sheriff actually is. And so the sheriff, technically, for a person to become a part of the military, become a part of the political class, I believe we actually have to have a cooling off period where that person actually has to step out of working and serving in the militia to, you know, for a period of years to where before they can become a politician. In other words, they kind of have to transition away from the autocracy of a military environment to a civilian environment. Does that make sense?
That is interesting.
Okay.
I thought about that, but that makes sense.
Right, because we want to make sure that, you know, if they don't always, because people tend, when you have force, they tend to lean on their force because it's a very effective tool. And we have to learn diplomacy. But you got to understand, everybody is going to be learning all of this stuff. Stuff that's never been taught in school, but it is critical because it's critical with, you know, human involvement, is teaching children to have difficult conversations with others. In other words, being able to sit down and work out your differences. Because if we did that, we would actually nub bullies in the butt. Because when we all of a sudden find that somebody is resorting to physical force and violence, then we that person, that child, needs to learn how to resolve their differences in a different way, that it is unacceptable to use force upon another person. And so just because you may have that power, you know, with power comes responsibility.
Right.
And so regardless of your advantages or what have you. So anyway, okay, so we've wrapped up this. But I know you're going to want to get into more, but I'll get into this on my presidential stuff where I actually break this all down. And so the reason why this is going to be a huge surge for everybody, everybody's going to have, you know, if you want liberty, you have to become a part of the enforcement of the Constitution, period. That is our, that is the duty of a citizen to support and defend the Constitution and be ready to be called up. And folks, if there's any time, if there is any time in the world, in the history of this nation, that there is a time to be called up, now is the time. It's now or never.
That's right. So, hey, if we have time,
we
Mr.
do.
Henry,
we got 12 minutes. Mr. Henry makes an interesting comment. I usually don't include anti-federalist comments, but this is the paradigm of the time, and this is why this is so important. And there's a little highlighted sentence in this. I think it just stands out, but go ahead and read. Go ahead.
Okay. May we not discipline? This is the title here is Every Man to Be Armed. May we not discipline and arm them as well as Congress if the power be concurrent, so that our militia shall have two sets of arms, double sets of regimentals, etc., and thus be, and thus at a very great cost, we shall be doubly armed. The great object is that every man be armed.
There it is right there. So the great object, is that every man be armed. This is what I've been saying, right?
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Go on. Keep on.
But can the people afford to pay for double sets of arms? Now, I'd like to know what he means by double sets of arms.
I think he's talking about armaments. He's talking about double sets of guns.
Okay. I just don't know why he is seeing that, but I'll go on.
Go ahead.
Everyone who is able may have a gun, but we have learned by experience that necessary as it is to have arms, and though our assembly has, by a succession of laws for many years, endeavored to have the militia completely armed, it is still far from being the case. When this power is given up to Congress without limitations or bounds, how will our militia be afraid? You trust to chance. For sure, I am that nation which shall trust its liberties in other hands cannot long exist. That's true. If gentlemen are serious when they suppose a concurrent power, where can be the impolicy to amend it? Or in other words, to say that Congress shall not arm or discipline it till the states shall have refused or neglected to do it? This is my object. I only wish to bring it to what they themselves say is implied. Implication is to be the foundation of our civil liberties. And when you speak of arming the militia by a concurrence of power, you use implication. But implication will not save you. When a strong army of veterans comes upon you, you will be laughed at by the whole world for trusting your safety implicitly to implication. GR, help me out with this paragraph.
Okay, so he's talking about and he's pointing out some of the weaknesses, because bottom line, as a militia and as an army, so he's looking at, you know, an army coming here to invade and to have to fight. And if this is what he's talking about, is a professional set of armies, they're going to laugh at you. They're going to mock us because we will not have the same discipline. And we just won't be able, if you really think about it, for America to be able to become as strong as it did, we really had to, you know, actually get out and fight wars. We really had to get out and get involved in world violent things, because that's what got us involved in the arms race. whether we like it or not. It's just like, oh, look at all the other countries that did not get involved in the arms race. There's always going to be the lust for power.
Right.
We had the recipe in the Constitution to quell the lust for power and curb it with the lust for liberty. Because the lust for power is by the few. The lust for liberty is by all. And we could have actually brought people, all of these nations could have been a part of the United States by now. Mm-hmm. Had we actually been emissaries and champions of the Constitution instead of the globalist agendas.
Right.
And brought a lot of different nations. I mean, I shudder to think, had we actually at the end of the 1800s, the end of the 19th century, started bringing in new nations, I mean, literally, you know, South America, Central America, to where all of the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere of the Western Hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere itself, all being a part of the United States. And then, you know, parts of Africa, parts of Asia, parts of Europe would start by now, by the end of the 20th century, you know, I could actually see how, you know, there'd be just small little vestiges where you would have these despotic countries. But America's reach, I mean, our necessity of having, you know, the defenses along our coast would really, you know, not have to be so bolstered. Because America would have been the world at this point. The United States would have been the majority of the world, where we would still have, you know, Russia, and we'd probably still have China. But they would not be dominating the world. Liberty would. Because when I say liberty, I mean liberty, not the United States.
Sure.
But because we went down this paradigm of force against force instead of liberty against force, because once you have liberty, the true liberty is something that all people will actually take a stand to defend. I mean, go watch Braveheart. Go watch the, you know, these fundamental ideals play out when tyranny starts to reign. The men will stand, and they will stand on the cause of liberty. The reason why nobody's standing today is because they don't recognize that our liberty has been taken.
Right.
Nobody understands, oh, well, this is good because we want our government to do these things. And they've completely lost sight that they have no liberty in the things the government is doing.
Right.
Right. So.
Well.
Anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, so now Mr. Nicholas now pipes in. In response to Henry, and he starts talking about martial law. So go ahead.
Right.
And actually, we've got 6 minutes, so I think you can get this one paragraph.
I
the
can
first
get
one.
This one in.
Okay, go ahead.
But his great uneasiness is that the militia may be under martial law when not on duty. A little attention will be sufficient to remove this apprehension. The Congress is to have power to, quote, provide for the arming, organizing, and discipline of the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, end quote. Another part tells you that they are to provide for calling them forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. These powers only amount to this, that they can only call them forth in these three cases, and that they can only govern such part of them as may be in the actual service of the United States. This causes a sufficient security that they will not be under martial law, but when in actual service. If, sir, a mutiny bill has continued since the Revolution, recollect that this is done under the present happy government. Under the new government, no appropriation of money to the use of raising or supporting an army shall be for a longer term than 2 years. The president is to command, but the regulation of the army and navy is given to Congress. Our representatives will be a powerful check here. The influence of the commons in England in this case is very predominant. But the worthy member on the other side of the house has said that the militia are the great bulwark of the nation, and wishes to keep no step to bring them, to take no step to bring them into disuse. What is the inference? He wishes to see the militia employed. The Constitution provides what he wants. This is to bring them frequently into use. If he expects that, by depriving the general government of the power of calling them into more frequent use, they will be rendered more useful and expert, he is generally greatly deceived. We ought to part with the power to use the militia. We ought to part with the power to use the militia to somebody? To whom? Ought we not to part with it for the general defense? If you give it not to Congress, it may be denied by the states. If you withhold it, you render a standing army absolutely necessary. For if they have not the militia, they must have such a body of troops as will be necessary for the general defense of the Union.
There you go. And so we got, actually, we got about 2 minutes and 45 seconds. So what he said here was a mouthful. And what he basically is saying here is that, because he's making comment that the worthy member on the other side of the House has said that the militia are the great bulwark of the nation, and he wishes to take no step to bring them into disuse. In other words, he wants to see them to be active. So in other words, we actually have to have regular drills. But the nation never did that. What they did was they said, well, we don't need it. We don't see any threat. They actually downplayed the militia and upplayed the use of the cavalry and, you know, the army in what we call the wild lands of the West. Well, but they should have been using the militia instead of a standing army.
Even in the territories?
Even in the territories. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because had they done that, and had they actually used the militia and used the mechanism of this, as we began to really start expanding with Manifest Destiny, and it all started, really, believe it or not, under Monroe.
Really?
Because it wasn't until the 1820s where railroads started really opening up the West and being able to move, you know, goods and services and those types of things to further and further out. And so that's really when the Manifest Destiny started beginning. And when you look at Manifest Destiny, we should have, had we had an active militia, you know, we would have actually had a very well-disciplined militia instead of actually having no disciplined militia and an active thug like Custer and these other guys that, you know, didn't understand diplomacy. They only understood force.
Interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting. So,
yeah.
So with that, we've got next week we'll be pulling up the militia some more, and this is all, again, folks, this is all on the 14th, and you know, because the 16th is Monday, and so the 14th is where they just covered a lot of details on the militia, and so we'll kind of wrap up with a militia, and then we will dive into a few more comments, and then we'll go into the 16th. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. And folks, we're out of time. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and the only way we can reclaim the Republic is with your help and with your knowledge of the Constitution, because as citizens, we have to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. It's that simple. Have a great evening.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.